Good afternoon, and welcome to the latest episode of Critical Reflections, my Truth and Reconciliation Project Grant podcast. I am T.T. Sternenzi, and today's episode will be part of Leading the Lad Way, a series of interviews and episodes I've been doing with employees at LAD. And I'm excited to bring in today's guest, Eric Grunefeld. We're going to be talking about his experiences at LAD, a little bit about kind of LAD's function in the greater Cincinnati community. And of course, as you know me, we'll also throw in some film and television conversation as well. So without further ado, let me turn things over to Eric and have him introduce himself to our listeners. Eric, is on you.
Okay, my name is Eric Grunefeld. I've worked at LAD for 29 years, 30 in April. I've worked at Brookside Extended Care as a QMRP for 15 years as well, but I stopped doing that in 2012. And I have four kids. They're William's going to UC as a sophomore, and I have a 19-year-old, soon to be 20, 16, 13, and 10. Wow. And I like watching a lot of soccer, try to get my kids to watch some soccer games, try to get them to watch go to Cirque du Soleil shows with me. They think they're all the same, but they're different, but I try to get them to go. Mm-hmm. I've seen quite a few over the years. The farthest I went was Ottawa to see a Cirque du Soleil show. It's 14 hours. And then I like seeing just general concerts, acrobatic shows, mm-hmm. some musicals, some stuff that's like at the Aronoff or Dayton Live, and see that periodically.
Okay. All right. I can already tell I've got a couple of ideas for questions that we'll move into as we move in, and once we get into sort of that entertainment phase of what we're talking about. I'm really excited about some of that you brought up. I want to focus, though, at least start here initially, going back to, I guess, the first question I really have is, what drew you to apply for and start working at LAD in particular?
I can't remember why I started. I know I got into the I started in the field because I had a professor who used to always say, what do you want to do when you get big? Instead of what do you want to do when you grow up? I always thought that was interesting. He was a pretty cool guy. Mm-hmm. And he got me into social work, which I've never actually used my degree. But started working at LAD. And I was actually working at two different locations. I worked with Cindy Gardeman. She was really good. Mm-hmm. And I worked at House 23, which is actually where I'm at now. Okay. I also worked in the community, but I had a supervisor who didn't really cared about the folks. He was more interested in cleaning than the people we were trying to help. Mm-hmm. And that kind of showed. And so I didn't want to work. And then an opportunity arrived here to go full-time. So I was part-time for just a couple months. Okay. And then I went to full-time. And I was full-time for probably a decade or so.
Wow. Okay. So you mentioned, interestingly enough, that you don't necessarily use your degree. Is your degree in social work?
Social work, yeah.
Okay. All right. That's funny because, yeah, I kind of always feel the same way because I actually have a business degree. But when I graduated from college back in 91, I actually started working in the field as well. I was an employment training specialist right out of college. It was at the beginning of the ADA. And I remember making the pitch to the person that I was interviewing with. It's like, okay, hey, I have this business degree, so I can go in and talk to employers and speak their language to be able to kind of convince them that, okay, you know, we're going to have the opportunity to bring someone in. I will support them. I'll do the job training. You know, you're going to get, you know, federal support for having this person come in. And you're also going to get, again, an extra employee in the deal too, because I'm going to be there as well. So you'll have two people basically doing the same job. And I didn't really know if that pitch was going to work when I actually got out in the field or not, but it worked in the interview.
Oh, that's good.
Got me a job, and sure enough, employers were more open and willing to consider that because, again, they knew they were going to get some of the employee support by having me there, but they also knew they were going to get, you know, a little bit of a discount in terms of, you know, that paycheck that was going into the person that we were supporting, because they knew they were going to get some federal dollars to sort of support that. So they're like, okay, fine, we'll do it.
That was like that.
Yeah. Like I said, that's as close as I feel like I've ever gotten to using my degree. And that's not really what I studied in school, but it was just enough to lure them in to say, okay, well, yeah, we'll give you a shot. Since then, like now I'm a film critic and, you know, an artistic director at film festival, and I don't use that business degree at all, really, in any meaningful way now. So yeah, I've had that degree for 30 plus years, and it's kind of funny that I feel like most people probably have a similar kind of experience. We both have kids. I've actually said the same thing to my kids. I'm like, yeah, you know what? It's not exactly what you get the degree in, but it's that you need to have the degree, because it'll keep doors open for you at the end of the day, and that's kind of really what you want to do. So yeah, I don't know if this is the lesson we want to be putting out there as part of this podcast, but yeah, it has worked out for both of us in a really interesting way. So
I agree with you.
Yeah. So I'm, like I said, this, and I've told you, you know, initially, and I kind of mentioned this to everyone that I've interviewed as part of Leading the Lad Way, that, you know, I have a unique kind of position here as a Lad employee, because I'm literally really only working for the festival. So I'm not really in direct support with people. But we make sure that, again, anyone from LAD, employees, people we support, whoever, will have the opportunity to attend the festival and actually be involved kind of behind the scenes. This past year, we had a group of people that were involved in helping us choose films for the festival. So that was a really exciting thing that we're able to do. But again, but I still feel like I'm a little removed from the everyday workings of LAD. So these interviews are a great opportunity for me to kind of hear from other people, get to know some people across the sort of the whole spectrum of the organization. And in your case, so far, you're the longest tenured person that I've spoken with here. So I guess it would be interesting to get your perspective on, you know, do you see or feel that there are any changes within the organization from when you started to where we are now? And that's a pretty long time frame to look at. And again, I'm thinking about just now too, because we have really embarked on, you know, an organizational restructure with the LAD Way, and the focus on making sure that we are living up to, you know, the social and cultural ideals that we, you know, are setting out for ourselves. So again, that feels like a big change for the organization. So I'm kind of wondering, from your perspective, having been here this long, you know, was there a before and after for you, or do you feel that LAD has kind of generally been on a pretty good path the entire way?
I think it's been on a pretty good path. There has been quite a bit of changes over the year. I think there's right now I'm in a house, it's an older house. Like when I first started, everybody was trying to get into their own apartment. So the goal was kind of like to move on to the next location, apartment on grounds, and then in the community.
Right.
And then I don't think that the goal today is not really that, it's support people where they're at. To help them out, learn things within the house, and then if they move to the community, like one of the new places, they you know, they do stuff there. I don't think there was anything with smart homes. We had Geyer and Find a Way, and then SOAR's been around for a while, but there was a lot less programs. So it's interesting to see how everything is just kind of like expanded.
Right.
And then some of the stuff that you think like has been there forever, I remember them putting in like the walkway from Victory Parkway to here. It used to be, people used to walk in the driveway when they got home from the bus, and they'd almost get hit each time. So David Robinson got a grant for that walkway. And so stuff like that has started. They didn't have this building. It was used, Cerebral Palsy Center was in the spot.
Right. Yeah.
So a lot of that stuff has changed.
Okay. Yeah. You mentioned the smart homes, and again, I don't know how if you're connected with with that at all, and I'm not either. No. But it's one of those really fascinating things that technology and how it can be used to change what an organization is doing as well. And I'm finding that really fascinating. The more that I hear about the smart home, because again, it provides an opportunity for, as you said, to really be able to provide support for people where they are, but also kind of, in a sense, you know, cut off some of that dependency on staff having to be there 24/7. Which again is kind of a game-changing kind of dynamic in a lot of ways, that again, we're looking at where that is now and who knows where that's going to go as we move forward. But, you know, discounting that for a moment, how has your experience been over the course of your time here, being there directly in people's homes and people's lives? How has that experience been for you?
I've enjoyed working with people. I think sometimes I think to myself that it actually is more helpful for the person sometimes if you don't help them as much. So if for an outside person, you might look like you're being lazy, but you're trying to get the person to do more for themselves, or let's say try to get them to remember what they need to do and try to do it in a way that you're not really like directly saying you need to shave, but like, what do you need to do today? Or if that doesn't work, what do you need to do with your face today? You're going out to visit family tomorrow. And then to get them to kind of remember, or if they are shaving themselves, to kind of like check themselves and go like, did you miss anything? Mm-hmm. And then if they don't get that, what spots did you miss? Okay, you missed this, you know, this spot. And try to like start out and give them, be kind of broad, and then kind of like give them more help if they're not quite getting what assistance they needed or how well they did particular things.
Right. Okay.
And I know like also we first started, we had a guy named Scott who was a psychologist. He did a lot of role plays with people. So you do like assertive role plays. I'm not sure where those went to, but they were kind of interesting because he would role play different situations like assertiveness or different other things, and it was just it would help people be a little bit better with different things. So it was
That's one of those things, like I said, for me, having started out really on the employment side, I didn't necessarily have to spend any direct time with people in their homes, but it was really just more the idea. I was probably coming in at the stage where, okay, the person has done all the stuff that you're talking about and they're getting ready to go to the job, and I would be at the door getting ready to say, okay, well, yeah, let's go get the bus, the subway, whatever we need to do, we get to work, and again, kind of doing those same kinds of things in the job. I would have that instruction sheet out in terms of, okay, here are the things that you need to do to accomplish your task, hopefully getting to the stage where at some point I didn't have to provide those prompts along the way. You know, week, 2 weeks, however long it would take, you get to the stage where, my presence, I could just be there and just be as a reminder to say, hey, well, did you do everything you needed to do? You know, are you sure you completed this full task before we move on to the next thing? So it was interesting because, again, a lot of probably what you do, you know, really transfers over to what someone like me would do, you know, on a job site for them.
And some of it is similar to what I actually, like, I have at home. So one of my kids has ADD, and he's a pretty smart kid, but he has a tendency to forget certain tasks in the morning. So, he likes having his foot halfway out of a shoe when he goes out the door. And so I say, did you do the things you need to do? And then that's like what I start off with. And then like, what do you need to do with your shoe? Or, you know, like, kind of like be more specific if he didn't do it, or, you know, check your zipper, you know, this, but, so some stuff he does really well, and then some stuff is not quite as well, but it's the same sort of thing. You're prompting somebody
And again, like I said, I feel like those kinds of things, those are all kind of those day-to-day pieces, whether, again, it's at home or at work, that you kind of make sure that people kind of understand and figure out, or again, get to the stage where they can figure out for themselves, okay, what am I doing? What do I need to do to be able to move on to the next thing? And I think that's a great starting point for us in this conversation. And I feel like the next, kind of that next step, but I used to do this as well, because once I transitioned out of being an employment training specialist, I was working for an organization in Philadelphia that actually trained staff that were supporting people. So I kind of moved up, and it was in the 90s. And, you know, again, this is where my film background is starting to pop into some of this, because I was using films during our staff trainings to talk about a lot of the issues. They were, and again, you know, in the 90s, we were at that phase where you had Forrest Gump and Rain Man and those kinds of films, and they were doing well, you know, at the box office. People were going to see them. You had, you know, Academy Award winning actors who were getting awards for those roles. But I remember being in trainings and kind of telling the staff that I was working with at the time, like, hey, these aren't necessarily great representations, although I probably didn't say the word representation back at the time. But it's just kind of like, it's just this, these stories and these characters really look like the people that we're working with. And starting to have that conversation in the mid-90s was, again, kind of a weird thing, because we weren't necessarily thinking about it in the way that we are today. But that was kind of the seed for us to get to where we are now. Like, having that conversation and understanding that, you know, Dustin Hoffman's character in Rain Man and the magical things that he can do, you know, knocking over, you know, a thing of toothpicks and being able to count how many toothpicks are on the ground. It's like, no, that's not a real world.
That's not a typical person.
Right. So I remember spending a lot of time, though, talking with the staff and kind of saying, hey, you know, there's a situation and an opportunity here that we need to be mindful of. And it was really more of just, you know, in a lot of cases, and again, the other thing that was going on at the time, you had, you know, black filmmakers who were finally getting to tell stories from the black perspective in film. But we were getting a lot of urban crime thrillers and all this kind of stuff that people were like, well, is this really the only black experience? Man. And it's like, no, we have a full spectrum of stories too, but the difference was, you know, the industry was finally opening up, so you were getting opportunities for other filmmakers to step in and to provide some of those narratives. And it was kind of like, well, for the disability community, we didn't necessarily have writers and directors and people who were there who were in positions to tell these stories. So it was like, well, if you're not going to do that, then we all need to be more mindful about those stories that we're telling and making sure that we try to find some way for them to be authentic. And it took us a long time to get to the stage that we're even at now. I'm kind of curious, especially working with people today, have you had any conversations, or do you see that people are kind of looking at these stories that are being told today, and are they saying, yeah, that looks like me, that looks like my experience? Or are they kind of saying, no, I don't really see myself on screen? Or are they even thinking about the idea of seeing representations like that?
You mean the people that we serve? Like,
yeah.
I don't know. I'm not really sure, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, I haven't really talked to, I know that that people enjoy going to the festival, but I haven't really talked to them about afterwards.
Yeah, I think that's, I feel like that's an interesting place for us to begin that conversation. Like, yeah, we, you know, like I said, from the festival this year, we worked with, you know, a group of people that were able to come in and help us choose. I think with this year it was the animated shorts. So we had a bunch of Zoom calls and everybody got to watch the films and then as a group kind of go through and kind of rate the films. And then out of that rating, that came back to my programming team, and we got to match up our rating system with the rating system from the team of people that were watching it. And again, we kind of got to say, okay, well, out of these two, we'll use that as a means of figuring out which films we were going to go with. But yeah, I don't know that we necessarily, and this is something that I'm thinking about now as a, you know, the festival coordinator for this, is like, yeah, I want to make sure that we go back and have those conversations with people to say, okay, yeah, we chose these films. What did you think about them? How did you feel about the choices that we made and the idea that you were involved in the process of choosing these films? Because, yeah, as a black man, I know I spend a lot of time watching TV shows and streaming shows and even movies, and always in the back of my mind, there's a little part of me that's always kind of like, well, does that story look like me?
Right.
You know, does it relate to me? Does it speak to me in a particular way?
Yeah, I think that would be good to ask.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree with this stuff? Do you not agree with this stuff?
Yeah. And I'm kind of curious now that we're sitting here having this conversation, like, you didn't necessarily mention a lot about film or television at the top of this. You talked about, and again, I'm still going to get you with the Cirque du Soleil stuff. I'm fascinated by that. But do you feel like when you're watching television shows or films or anything else, are you ever mindful or question what you're watching in terms of your own experiences?
Well, yeah, I think the more you know about something, the more it something could seem like inauthentic if you, it's not to, like, for example, my sister likes, she was in dance for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So she'll point out, like, that's not how you do it. And I'll say, it looks fine to me. It's like, no, that's not how you do it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I like soccer. It seems like it's hard to do a sports movie where the ending seems real. Like, we have fantastic endings when you watch sports in real life, but when you're watching them in a movie, it just seems fake.
Right.
Even if exactly the same thing happened, it just seems very contrived. But so a lot of the soccer stuff I watch, I'm like, no, that's not.
Yeah.
That's not how it goes.
That's pretty funny. You should mention soccer too, because everybody, of course, is in this moment where we're all caught up with Ted Lasso. It's, you know, a kind of a big cultural thing, and Ted Lasso is a really weird show just about the idea of an American football coach going to England to coach a soccer team.
Oh, okay.
And he knows nothing at all about the sport of soccer, which is why he was chosen, because the whole point was he was being set up to fail.
Mm.
But he gets there, and his, you know, right-hand man assistant coach does know more about soccer and is there to kind of help guide him and steer him through it all. And he's a really great inspirational figure who is able to use that along with his assistant coach's knowledge to be able to help this team move ahead. But yeah, I watched the soccer, you know, the little staged moments in the show where they're on the pitch and you're kind of like, it doesn't feel right. And I don't even watch that much soccer, but I can watch and kind of go, yeah, that doesn't feel right. But the cool thing about the show is you're not supposed to worry about that piece of it. It's really everything else that goes on. But it is interesting, though, that in those moments, it kind of takes you out of that feeling.
Well, like, I really like the movie She's All That, but there's a character, Zach, and he's on a soccer field, and I'm like, he looks pretty uncoordinated for being a star player.
Yeah.
I mean, I like the movie overall, but it takes me out more than someone else who doesn't watch soccer. They just see it and probably go, like, he's fine or whatever.
Yeah.
But for me, it's like, I have to get pulled out and go, like, that's not real. And it takes me a couple minutes to get back into it again.
Yeah. Well, and here's another question for you, since we're, like, on the soccer tip for a minute here. It's one of those sports that my kids played when they were younger, but they weren't really serious about it. But I'd spent a lot of weekends, you know, with my wife, you know, shuttling the kids back and forth between matches and the whole deal. But now, having a team here, I still haven't, well, I've seen one match so far. How do you feel about FC Cincinnati?
I like the fact that we have a team.
Mm-hmm.
The crowd is just phenomenal.
Yeah.
The crowd is just phenomenal. I wish they would have a better team.
Okay.
Because so they don't have a great team, but the crowd, I mean, once, and the management is building, is trying to get players in. They've had good, reasonably good coaches.
Mm-hmm.
They just haven't worked out. But the attendance is always very, very good, especially for a team that hasn't done as well.
Right.
Because there was no FC Cincinnati until like 4 or 5 years ago, really,
right,
when it became bigger. I usually go and see like 3 or 4 Columbus Crew games a year. So I've and then I just kind of ask whichever kids want to see them. So,
right.
And then they have some like national team games up there, but so that's a lot of fun to go up there. But so I haven't seen as much FC Cincinnati here. I have enjoyed that. The crowd is just great, though. It's really great.
Yeah, I'm curious about it because again, yeah, soccer is one of those sports that within the country we haven't quite risen to embrace it yet. But again, we're a sports based nation in a lot of ways, whether it's baseball or football or basketball. So adding another sport in doesn't seem like it would be a problem for fan bases. It's just again getting the base and giving them a team that they want to get behind that's going to do well and have some success. But yeah, you know, we probably get a grace period. You got maybe 5 years where the inspiration and the base will be just excited to finally get something. But then at some point, yeah, you're going to have to win.
And this is a big soccer city for high schoolers and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
My only sibling is in Austin, Texas, and they just had a Major League Soccer team start there, which was very surprising because it's not the... When she talks about it, it's high school football, and it's the University of Texas, and they're really not that interested in soccer. But it's worked so far. Mm-hmm. I guess there's enough people who have been interested in it.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that, too, says an awful lot about the cities themselves, which is really one of the things that I'm fascinated by why I asked you the question about FC Cincinnati, because as a city, you know, we've had baseball and football on the professional level, and with soccer coming in, it's like, okay, that's yet another opportunity for the city to expand, you know, and expand its interest and kind of hopefully have a footprint again in this new sport as it's coming in. And I think about that in the same way with the festival, because we're a top 40 or 50 market in the country. And having that status, but yet not having a really fully developed long-term festival is kind of one of those things. It's like, well, here's an opportunity that we have to really build this event and to do it well and to do something different with it, which for us, you know, kind of moving, transitioning and rebranding ourselves from Real Abilities to the OTR International Film Festival was that opportunity to be able to say, okay, well, we're going to take disabilities and the disability community and find ways to incorporate it into this larger industry discussion of diversity and inclusion and all of that. Just because up to this point, when we've been talking about the idea of diversity and inclusion within the film industry, we've really been talking about people of color and women and the LGBTQ community. We hadn't really been talking about the disability community. So our festival is kind of a way to say, well, hey, let's make sure that, you know, as we're talking about intersectionality and everything else, let's make sure that we're doing the best that we can to include everyone under that umbrella. And if that's the niche that our festival is going for and we're building it, like I said, if we had the opportunity to really create something special, it looks like and it feels like the city's willing to embrace that. So again, it's an exciting time. So yeah. You know, soccer, now the festival. Yeah, Cincinnati's in a really interesting place. And I didn't ask this. Are you originally from Cincinnati?
From Dayton, Ohio.
So from Dayton. Okay. Yeah, I'm actually not from here either. I've kind of bounced around and traveled a lot. But I've been here 21 years now. So I feel like for better or for worse, this is my home. And I'm excited to be here.
Mine's... 18 to 20. I think it's like 18 or 19 years. So.
Okay. So, yeah, you came from Dayton. And I actually, for a brief time in I guess, the middle of my career, I actually wrote for Dayton City Paper. Mm-hmm. So I used to go up to Dayton every once in a while and check out films and talk to people up there. So, yeah, I love the connection that Actually, I kind of love the connection that all of the cities in Ohio, the major cities, have. Like, I sometimes go up to Columbus for screenings because, you know, especially now, you know, with the way things have changed, you know, as part of COVID, if a studio isn't going to do, if they don't feel like they can afford to do films in every city, they'll do, they'll kind of match up Cincinnati and Columbus.
Oh, okay.
So, cool. You know, I'll either go up there or the critics up there will come down here for screenings. And, you know, it's, like I said, there's an interesting camaraderie that we have. And, you know, Dayton is kind of in that mix too. That it's, yeah, it's kind of fascinating. So that leads me to another question for you, just about being from Dayton, but now having spent this much time here, how has this region changed, or what do you see have been changes over your lifetime? I just kind of sprung.
No, I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. It's just one of those, again, I think about those kinds of questions because I'm from Asheville, North Carolina. And usually when I say that, people are always like, oh, Asheville's such a cool place. And I'm like, well, yeah, it is now. But, you know, 40 years ago, it was a very different city than it is now. You know, it's kind of like Austin in a lot of ways. It's got this really quirky alternative indie kind of vibe to it, and you know, the downtown is, you know, there aren't that many chain stores, there are lots of restaurants and all this kind of stuff now, but like I said, 30-40 years ago when I was a kid growing up there, most of that stuff didn't exist. So I can look at it and say, well, yeah, like where it is now versus where it was when I was growing up in the 70s and the early 80s, it's like, yeah, it's a completely different place.
I think that's, well, that's, when you mentioned that, that's part of the reason why we live kind of where we're at. Where my parents, well, where I grew up, was near the Dayton Mall. So what they said when they moved in there, there was no stores. And then from the Dayton Mall exit off of 75 to our house, like 4 miles, there's like several hundred stores. Like it's totally built up.
Right.
So we wanted a spot that was less built up. So we live near Wynn Woods, because on Wynn Road, they're not going to like tear down the woods, or not likely to.
Yeah.
So it has some stores, and it tends to take a little longer to get to places, but there's not stuff, you know, right on top of each other.
Right. Like,
so it's a little bit more nature. You get to see more more deer and stuff, and occasionally raccoons. I've told the kids to stay away from them. And
makes sense.
Turtles, rabbits, and stuff like that. We've seen all sorts of stuff in our backyard. But.
Yeah. Hang on 1 second. I made a little bit of a mistake here. Bear with me. A little technical interlude that we just had there. We are back on track. And yeah, we were talking about, again, the idea of, you know, changing cities, different locations. You were talking about where you live, and I was struck by the idea. I was thinking about that because I live downtown. I live in Pendleton, OTR area. But I've only been down there for a couple of years, but my wife and I used to spend a good bit of time down in that area before we even moved down. And as I was asking you just about changes here in the city, I think about that because when we got married in 06, there wasn't a lot going on in OTR.
No. And I actually worked in OTR too, quite a few years ago. You're right. Like it was a little scary in parts, but now it's been built up and it's a lot of good parts there. Yeah. We used to see they had a movie theater on Race Street and used to see a lot of movies there, and they had kind of like the unusual movies.
Yeah, that was a little before my time being here, which is so funny because as a film critic, I hear about that theater almost more than anything else whenever I talk to people here, and it's always fascinating because I'm always kind of like, man, like, I missed that probably by 3 to 5 years, but it's such a touchstone for a lot of people, especially like with the interviews I've done for the podcast, as I've talked to people from here, they always talk about that spot. And I had similar spots in North Carolina and in Philly, you know, where I went to college, that you could say, well, yeah, I, you know, we hung out at that theater and that was kind of the cool, fun place to see this really great stuff. And I missed it here. So in a lot of ways for me, the festival is the opportunity to try to find and build some new kinds of spaces and memories like that. So I'm really excited that we have the opportunity to do the programming, to really reach out and to be a part of that community. You know, for us doing those outdoor screenings in July, you know, near Braxton and Pendleton and, you know, in the parks at Washington Park and Ziegler, it was kind of cool because it was like, okay, yeah, hopefully someone came to the festival and had a great experience at one of those screenings, and 10 or 15 years from now, they'll be saying, well, yeah, I remember when the festival was really just getting started and they did those outdoor screenings that year during the pandemic, and now they're doing all this other really crazy great stuff. So yeah, you know, you want to have those kinds of memories then that sense of community that people will feel connected to. So yeah, I'm excited that we have that opportunity. And before we go, I have to ask you, because again, you know, you mentioned at the top, Cirque du Soleil. And in particular, you mentioned how far you're willing to travel to go check it out. So I have that one trip that you mentioned. Did you drive?
Yeah. Wow. So I drove. They were retooling a show, Saltimbanco, which is now no longer there. But most of it went into the Mystere show in Vegas, mm-hmm. which is very good. And I drove there and they did four shows. Mm-hmm. I still remember, I think the most amazing thing probably is they had a lady do a backwards flip from a high wire onto another high wire like 3 feet away, which just blew me away. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. And yeah. I actually did, my wife was really understanding. Like my kids were, let's see how old they were, but it's like 6 and 2. And I went up to Toronto and saw some Cirque du Soleil shows, drove back to Cincinnati, went to Toronto by myself, and she was with the kids,
right,
with the boys, drove back to Cincinnati, and then we all drove back up to Toronto.
Wow.
for a week.
Yeah.
And did some stuff in Toronto, Niagara Falls, and mm-hmm. stuff like that.
Yeah.
And she didn't really want to see the Cirque du Soleil. She was always like, I've seen one Cirque du Soleil show, they're all the same. I was like, no, they're all totally different. But she was, and before I had kids, I had, you know, you have more money. So mm-hmm. I actually saw like some shows like 4 times. And I would, okay. I would say like, there was one I remember where somebody was like, he was on a high wire and he fell off and caught it. And people were like, oh, that's amazing. The audience was gasping. He did it 4 straight shows, and there was nothing on the floor. It was like 20 feet off the ground.
Wow.
And he, like, to be that talented to like intentionally fall off, yeah, and catch yourself 4 different shows.
Yeah.
And so it was interesting. And I'd also try not to point out, but there's also like some ringers, and I try not to, you know, I knew who the ringers, I believe, like this show has a ringer, yeah, but I try not to tell people. I got pulled into one show and they told me what to do. They were mm-hmm. like, my back was to the audience, but they told me like what I was supposed to be doing. And I was there for like a minute or two. And yeah, I was part of the act as they pull people up, which I thought I'd have a lot of trouble with, but people said I did pretty well.
Okay.
Kind of a couple of people say I was a ringer. So I felt pretty good for people to think that. But
wow. That's actually funny on a lot of levels. As I'm thinking that through, like even you going back to talking about the trip and all that, that kind of reminds me of like my experience as a film critic and going to festivals before I started working for our festival here. Like, yeah, I would go up, as a matter of fact, I would go up to Toronto every year. And my wife, she used to get annoyed when I would say that she doesn't like film as much as I do. And again, it doesn't matter that she likes it as much as I do or not. I used to say, you just don't like movies at all. But yeah, like that trip for me, I would go up and I would see, you know, 3 or 4 movies a day over the course of, you know, anywhere from like a long weekend to eventually a week to sometimes staying for the entire festival. And she was just like, yeah, I can't imagine wanting to do that on a regular basis, like seeing all those films. It's just like, eh, that's just your thing. You go do that. And in a very similar way, I've been up with my wife and my kids because she has family up there, and we'll go up, you know, at a time when the festival's not going on so that I can kind of go and experience the city and hang out with them and that stuff. But yeah, when I go up for the festival, it's just me and maybe a friend who's a programmer. We'll go up and we'll watch stuff together. But that's, like I said, that's the thing that my wife is just never going to get.
I used to watch more movies. I had one time, it was kind of a weird experience. I think it was between sophomore and junior year. Mm-hmm. I was in the summertime, and my mom indulged me, and I went to the library, and I saw, literally, I was trying to see all, like, what they call the best movies of all time, like, mm-hmm. Bicycle Thieves, Battleship Potemkin, a lot of foreign films.
Oh, yeah.
And then, and some of which I liked, some of which I didn't like. And then I saw 150 movies in one summer, which is, like, about 4 hours a day, and I got burnt out for like a couple years.
Yeah,
and only watched like 10 movies a year, and then I slowly kind of, you know, I watch much, but not nearly that
many. You're working your way back up.
But we have like a family night. We've had it since the pandemic, so every Saturday we watch like 2 or 3 movies. We've been doing it at home for the most part,
right?
And then I get popcorn, I get like some snacks and like some pop, and you know, we order pizza or whatever. And then we watch like 2 or 3 movies. People pick out stuff. Mm-hmm. Emma always picks Scooby-Doo. And so she picks like the same thing every time. But right. But we watch different movies. And my oldest son he enjoys like seeing what movies like that I would like. And my second old Christopher likes. And so we've been doing that. And then we've seen occasional movies. We saw Spider-Man. So
okay. Yeah. But yeah, it's funny because I mentioned it before we kicked this conversation off, the idea that this episode is going to run, for those who are listening, it's going to run in January. But we're actually taping this December 23rd. So as you were talking about this, I'm thinking about, yeah, my family, we're gonna get, you know, we have everyone together, and on Christmas Day we either usually go to the movies and then have Chinese food, or again, like this year, we're probably not gonna go to the movies, but we're gonna watch a couple of things. And I just had a conversation this morning with my son, like, okay, well, you know, who do we think is gonna be here? Because I want to make sure everybody gets to vote for what we're gonna watch. And yeah, same kind of deal. We won't do the popcorn and all that. Like I said, for us, we'll be getting, we'll order Chinese takeout. And, you know, we'll have takeout containers all over the kitchen and everything. And
Sounds cool.
And we'll be watching movies. So I love that. That's, again, it's that communal experience within the family. You know, and again, for me, it's kind of the same thing with the festival. I want people who come to the festival to kind of be able to build and have those kinds of connections where they're either coming with friends or family, or they meet people while they're at these screenings or at the events that we have and the parties, so that they can say, well, yeah, you know, you're building a larger community and a larger family of people that you'll want to connect with year after year. Mm-hmm. And we'll all have those kinds of experiences. And you'll think back on, hey, you know, the people that I met last year, let's see if they're going to come and experience this stuff again, you know, next year. We can maybe add some new people to that experience. So that's the exciting part of this. And honestly, that's also the exciting part of doing this podcast and having these conversations, because it gives me, as I said, the chance to meet some new people. So Eric, I want to thank you for joining me for this conversation. And I hope you had fun with it. Yeah, I know I did. Good. And let me just say, I hope all of the listeners tuning in for this episode of Leading the Light Way, I hope you're enjoying this conversation too. And know that we've got at least one more coming up. And who knows, we may continue this series even after the February episode. So stay tuned. But thank you very much. And I'm saying it now because we're not officially there. But again, Happy New Year.